time once again for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy. Hello, Stacy.
Hi, Max Kaiser. We're back in London. Anything exciting happening? I see we do have a great headline on maxkaiser.com.
Yes, the U2's Glastonbury gig is targeted by UK Uncut.
And why is that? I guess they're acting kind of French in this, the way they're working on behalf of the Irish people, because obviously you two are Irish citizens, but so why are they targeting them for their tax evasion?
Well, UK Uncut is a group that's out there. And I guess it's UK. Yeah, they're trying to go after all the financial terrorists, including Vodafone, Philip Green's Top Shop, Boots, and Grocers to the Queen, Fortnum and Mason. And they are drawing attention to the tax shenanigans that these companies and individuals are involved with. And, of course, the idea is, why should the people in Britain be exposed to the austerity measures when these corporations who are in bed with the politicians are able to avoid paying taxes? So the idea is, well, these people should pay their taxes and therefore take the pressure off these austerity measures. And caught in the crosshairs is U2. And we've been talking about this on this show for a number of years. You know, you've got U2 relocated outside of Ireland through a fairly exotic tax avoidance scheme that puts them through the Netherlands in one leg of the scheme. And as a result, they're tax dodgers. They're Irish tax dodgers. And as a result, of course, that's part of the reason why the Irish economy is being going through these austerity measures, is because of the malfeasance, the larceny, the kleptocracy, and the embezzlement. I mean, you got Bono is basically embezzling money from Irish taxpayers vis-a-vis the tax avoidance scams and schemes that technically are legal, but that's what revolutions are all about. When the laws are written by the kleptocrats, the people revolt, and that's why the people are revolting in Cairo and Tunis and Dublin and Athens and London, all over the world. They're revolting because you can't really look at the laws anymore. The laws are written by the kleptocrats. There's been a breakdown in the social contract, so don't look at the law. Law is meaningless. Meaningless law. Law is meaningless. So it goes on here. Campaigners claim U2 is the latest big name to avoid paying tax. Plan includes Bono pay up banner for the band's headline set. It goes on to say that the Glastonbury gig by U2 is being targeted by protesters. First it was Vodafone, then Philip Green, Boots, Grocers to the Queen, Putnam and Mason. Now direct action tax protesters are turning their sights on the Glastonbury Festival, promising to use U2's headline performance to throw a spotlight on the group's convoluted tax affairs, read larceny. Campaigners have promised to stop short of disrupting the set, but are determined to make their protest highly visible. Plans are afoot for a giant inflatable banner with the slogan, "Bono pay up, you ponce," spelled out in lights. Bono claims to care about the developing world, but U2 greedily indulges in the very kind of tax avoidance which is crippling the poor nations of this world. Right, so Stacy, we've been saying this for many years now. The Bono, the aging rocker who was quickly becoming irrelevant, got himself attached to these We Are the World type mega concerts and serenading the Queen and her minions to try to extend his career past the sell-by date. Done a good job doing so, but in the process became a partner at a private equity firm, became a tax avoidance scoundrel. And, you know, he's become a caricature of himself, hasn't he?
Yeah, and I think this is an important step with UK Uncut and this division. They seem to have battalions here. This group of uncut activists is Art Uncut, they call themselves. So they're not just being myopic and looking at their own belly button lint. They're looking at everybody's, you know, they're united with all the peasants of the world. So I see they also say that they're going, if Bono thinks he is just like any other Irishman, he should pay his taxes like everyone else. We will be showing the very real impact of U2's tax avoidance on hospitals and schools in Ireland. Anyone watching will be very much aware that Bono needs to pay up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they have mined heavily the history and culture of Ireland to make hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. Bloody Sunday, Bloody Sunday. Okay, this is mining the troubles in Northern Ireland for a, you know, billion-dollar payday. And they position themselves as part of the resurgent Celtic Tiger, you know, and they drape themselves in the Irish flag. But do they pay their taxes to Ireland? Are they Irish citizens? No, they are not. They are larcenistic, embezzling scoundrels.
Well, by the way, you know, the reason why they're being targeted is because basically U2 didn't pay any taxes anyway until 2006 because of that artist law in Ireland, which was meant to help starving artists. You know, they didn't have to pay any taxes on their royalties. And then it turned out that upon examination, it was only benefiting people like U2. So the government introduced a cap on the amount of royalties on which would be tax-free. And that was like 225,000 euros. So still, you know, it was affecting starving artists, middle-class artists, and upper-middle-class artists who would get tax-free. But Bono thought that was too much, and then they left for tax reasons.
Yeah. So, and also remember a few years ago, they came out with that campaign Red, where they were going to brand all kinds of consumer merchandise with this Red label, and that a portion of the sales would go to help the starving people. That turned out to be a huge scam and a huge flop, another money milker for the oligarchs, where the, you know, using the poor people as props to engender sympathy and tears that you're milking unmercifully. And not only do they, you see, this is what's really bad, is that a country like Ireland needs help now from its staunchest citizens to come in there and fight the banksters who are raping, financially raping that country unmercifully with their giant credit default swap sticks. And where's Bono? Not only does he not help his country, he's avoiding his taxes, and they should, what's the word when you disavow a citizenship for somebody? They are basically thrown out of the country, or they're made, in Islam.
Exiled.
They're exiled. He should be exiled. You know, then he might be an interesting rock and roll guy again, because this country of Ireland exiled him for being a ponce. And then he can make music about, being a ponce, being in exile. But he just loses on every one of these fronts. We've been saying this for years, particularly on this show and Residence 104, the musicians cooperative, you know. And the musicians here know that Bono's a frickin' ponce who can't sing his way out of a paper bag. And now UK Uncut Art is ripping him a new a-hole. So campaigners also want to draw attention to the impact of tax avoidance on Ireland's perilous public finances. We will be showing the very real impact of U2's tax avoidance on hospitals and schools, like you just said. The band sparked a wave of criticism in 2006 by shifting parts of its business from Ireland to the Netherlands in response to a cap, right? Previously, worldwide royalties earned from works of art, right? Dr. Sheila Killian of the University of Limerick said the introduction of a cap, originally £250,000, was still generous, but Bono decided it wasn't generous enough. Another campaigner, Richard Murphy, said if Bono thinks he's just like any other Irishman, he should pay his taxes, right? Protesters at Glastonbury are planning to float an oversized bundle of fake cash from one part of the crowd under an Irish tricolor to another section of the audience under a Dutch flag. Oh, that's clever, isn't it, Stacey?
To fly it under a Dutch flag?
They're showing the cash being moved from Ireland to the Netherlands.
Yeah.
An oversized bundle of fake cash, and they're going to have a visual crowd participation. And that's pretty clever. That'll get the crowd into it. Now, the question is, when he shows up on stage, will he be booed, as he should be, for all these crimes against his country?
Will he be booed? Well, when we were in Dublin last, and you were doing your stand-up rage tour through Dublin, I think Bono better be careful there. These Irish people today, they're a little bit angry, I'd say, about the situation. And remember, Bono is not only a guy who sells records, he's also a banker.
Yeah, he's the Sean Fitzpatrick of rock. who's the other guy named Mark somebody or some other scoundrel in Ireland.
Yeah.
A spokesman for U2, who are in Vancouver pretending to be relevant rockers, was unavailable for comment. Their manager, Paul McGuinness, has previously insisted, he should change his name from Paul McGuinness to Paul McSchlitz. You know, again, here's a guy milking the Guinness name.
Oh, yeah.
Or call himself Paul McBudweiser. Or Paul McCoca-Cola, but don't
Carlsberg.
Yeah, Paul McCarlsberg, the Dutch beer, but don't again milk the Irish brand for your ill-gotten gains, you schmata.
Now, Carlsberg might be German. I don't know.
What's that one? Grolsch.
Grolsch. Grolsch. That sounds German.
Yeah, they got the woman on the label with those huge tatas. That's the one I like. So Paul McGrolsch had previously insisted U2 is a global business and pays taxes globally at a rate that's near 0%, and we don't give a fig about those stupid Irish poor schmatas. At least 95% of U2's business takes place outside of Ireland, so eat me. That's a nice thing to say, isn't it? Sources close to the band said Bono and others live in Ireland are employers there and are involved in philanthropic activities. The philanthropic activities are a front. They are a marketing item on the global brand that is U2. That's a big canard right there.
Bernie Madoff was a big philanthropist as well.
Yeah, exactly. So he's the Bernie Madoff and the Sean Fitzpatrick of the rock world. A spokesman for One, the anti-poverty campaign group co-founded by Bono, said, U2's business management have nothing to do with the illegal eat me, you ponce. One is currently lobbying for radical changes in the law that would require extractive industry corporations to report payments to governments to ensure the substantial resources contribute to the domestic tax base. I like this. I like that phrase, the extractive industry. You know, and they're just extracting the wealth from the country. They're just mining. These people are schmucks. How can anyone? I hope they get booed right off stage.
Boo. Hey, you know, it also results in another really shocking image and headline we have at maxkaiser.com about labor's share of the income in America. And it's at the lowest ever in U.S. history, the share of labor of the income of the nation. And I think it's David Rosenberg, the analyst. He says that basically he compares it to the October Revolution times. So before the Bolshevik uprising and that sort of period where you saw big revolutions, and this is a dangerous thing. But remember the weird cult that you have in America. Look at all those millions of people who join the Tea Party in order to take more away from labor. You know, they're more angry with their neighbor, like we always talk about.
What are you prattling on about? Let's focus in on what you're talking about here, which is that some recovery it has been, a recovery in which labor's share of the spoils, and this is not the Labor Party, this is the people who work for a living, labor, the labor force, has declined to unprecedented levels. Not only does the U.S. already have the core elements, should one be so inclined, to provoke a rather active anti-fascist movement based on some interpretations of pro-corporatist policies adopted by the administration, but should another be so inclined, the country also has the groundwork in place for another neo-Marxist revolution, right? So This is a very interesting statistic, as you point out. Never in history in America has the share of income that trickles down to labor been so low.
That's correct. And what do you think? Do you think his interpretation is correct that there will be a neo-fascist or a neo-Marxist revolution?
Well, he's saying the conditions are ripe. And we've been saying that there's a global insurrection against corporate occupation and banker occupation, and we've been noticing that the crime in the banking sector is so pervasive, and the amount of money that they're stealing is so huge, and the amount of people now on food stamps in the U.S., the amount of people now below the poverty line in the U.S., you see that the jobs number came out on Friday. They only added something like 56,000 jobs. They were expecting 200,000 jobs. And, of course, half of the 56,000 jobs were contributed to McDonald's, which recently did a stunt where they hired 50,000 people in one day to be hamburger flippers. You remember last year, as part of the scam from the Labor Bureau of Statistics, they reclassified hamburger flipping at McDonald's from a service job to a manufacturing job. So that's part of the charade that's going on. And so there's almost, if you take out the McDonald's stunt, there was really zero jobs added. And you need, just to keep track, keep up with the population growth, you would need 200,000 to 300,000 jobs a month just to kind of break even in terms of keeping the unemployment rate below 20 to 22%, which is getting your depression levels. So where did it come in at? Zero. Zero. So they bring up a couple of interesting things here. Probably the most important secular trend in recent employment data, one that has far greater impact on the macroeconomic themes than the birth, death, and seasonal adjustment manipulated month-to-month shifts in the employment pool per either the household or establishment surveys. Okay, there's quite a mouthful there. They refer to the birth-death model. That's not birth-death of people. That's birth and death of companies. Because the jobs number is based on estimates. One of those estimates is the number of new companies being born in that particular period of time. And then they make an assumption about how many jobs would be part of that new company. And so this is used to look into the employment data. The seasonal adjustment, of course, this is a number that is manipulated or adds to some noise into the picture, because during the busy end of the year Christmas season, many retailers go on a hiring binge of part-time employees. They need to wrap those presents that people buy on their credit cards and tie little pretty bows that are made in China. Then they talk about the household versus the establishment survey. These are two different ways to look at the employment. Two completely separate views that are used to, again, add noise and confusion into the basic proposition here of asking ourselves, what is the situation in terms of labor? So what they're saying here is that the labor share of national income, if you just look at that one and not these other ones, you get a good picture of what's really going on. And the allocation of national income between workers and the owners of capital is considered one of the more remarkable stable relationships in the U.S. economy. As a general rule of thumb, economists often cite labor share of income to be about 2/3 of national income. But what we've seen is a degradation of that, and it's never been lower. Labor share of national income has fallen to its lowest level, okay, in modern history. So I guess not in history, but in modern history. So I guess that would be post-World War II.
Well, their chart goes back to 1950, yeah. So, and it's now down to 57%. So they're saying the assumption is 2/3. And the dramatic collapse has come since 2000, if you see that. And it's marked also by a time of worsening and worsening and worsening economy, and people are totally baffled about why it's getting worse. Whereas if you think of a good economy, it was under Clinton. And look at how that's when it spiked up back almost to where it had been before it fell under Reagan and Bush 1.
Yeah, that 2/3 number is pretty, bouncing around between 63 and 67% from 1950 through 2000. Then in 2000, it falls off a cliff. It goes from 66% down to 56%, which is a huge drop. And it's gathering speed on the downside. And I mean, let's talk about this. Let's break this down in terms of what happened in 2000 and 2001. In 2000, the dot-com bubble burst, and you had a $5 trillion crack up on the NASDAQ in the U.S. And the Federal Reserve, as part of their continuing mission to support stock prices, even though at the expense of the what's called the real economy, they support Wall Street over Main Street, they dropped interest rates to this really low level of 1 or 2%. This started the housing bubble, which became much bigger than any previous stock bubble. And, of course, in 2001, you had the 9/11 attacks, which also produced another enormous drag on the economy. All of the flow of cash that went into the Homeland Security and invading countries and the war effort in the Pentagon. So that's also the debts in the U.S. Not only did they bail out, and then the 2008, right? The crash of 2008, which generated a $7 trillion bailout of Wall Street, plus many more trillions of dollars of fiscal bailout, like of the motor, of the car industry from the Obama administration, and you know, work programs from the Obama that did nothing, that added nothing but a few temporary jobs. And all of these huge mistakes since the year 2000. So you had all of this now contributing to the collapse of the job market, the confiscation of wealth by the top 1%. And according to this story, this is typically when you see the workers revolt, you know, what they're calling a Marxist-Leninist revolution or an anti-fascist revolution. So does this have weight? Is the economy so bad as it was in the 1930s? Remember when you had the Communist Party in America took a huge leap forward in the 1930s? Are we going to see an anti-fascist revolt in the U.S.? Well, according to this economist here on ZeroHedge.com, which goes out to mostly hedge fund managers, you know, these are not political wonks. They don't even give a fig about politics. They're just looking for trades. They're saying the probability of a anti-fascist workers' revolt is growing to the point where you can't ignore it anymore. You've got to discount that in your pricing models on your portfolios. So it's, you know, I'll give you another thing to think about, Stacey. In the year 2000 is when I started to quite vocally talking about how the insurance industry had started to discount climate change, man-made climate change and global warming in their models, and how this would affect the economy, regardless of whether you were a denier or not. Now, 10 years later, I see Mitt Romney, who's a candidate for the Republican Party to be president, has broken ranks from the Republicans and the Tea Parties and the people with their head in the sand, saying that man-made global warming is real and it's a big factor. Now, that took 10 years, but now suddenly, based on my analysis, by just looking at the money flows, now this has been confirmed politically 10 years later. We've been talking about the conditions for an anti-fascist revolution for 5-6 years. Now the hedge fund industry and the insurance industry and the Economist magazine, who was trying to handicap countries that were going to be revolting 2 years ago in their year-end issue, that's coming online. This is really happening. This is part of the discounting mechanism you must take on board to survive financially. There is now this anti-fascist revolution that's taking hold.
Yeah, but, okay, so he's saying an anti-fascist revolution. So he's saying a revolution against corporatism, against corporate ownership. But when you look at the fact that so many people are like a Tea Party Coke bot sort of thing, they're a total cipher for propaganda from these very corporations. You see that, I mean, as that chart, when you look at that chart, the cascading down in the last 2 years of the share of wealth held by the labor, this is also a time where you see an exponential growth in hate for labor and hate for poor people and hate for this sort of thing. And also an escalation of propaganda that Obama is the most radical socialist Marxist president in history. And yet, if you look at the chart, if you look at the evidence, if you look at the empirical evidence, there is no evidence for that.
Right. And, you know, we were watching this five-part series on the history of Ireland, and it brought home an interesting point that when the Protestants moved into Northern Ireland and they started to dominate the country's politics and they became an occupying force is when all of the anti-Irish propaganda was launched, and to portray the Irish, the indigenous population, if you will, as shiftless, lazy bums. You see, the occupiers always describe the people that they're occupying in unflattering terms, in racist terms. So the occupying, the bankers who are occupying this American and global economy are describing the people that they're occupying in unflattering terms. They're calling them all worthless bums, you know, and whatever. I mean, this makes sense because they spew the hatred against the people that they're occupying because it's a way to deflect attention from themselves as being the occupiers. You know, you see this in everywhere you see an occupying force, whether it's the racism in America against the immigrants and the folks who came in now, you know, the Mexican people coming in, they're being totally vilified. But you see this all the time.
Well, you see it from the Israelis against the Palestinians, the American, the colonialists against the Native American Indians. Yeah, the occupiers always do that. They have to demonize that. But I want to ask about that chart, because if you look at any sort of market or trend, I mean, it's quite clear that it was in a channel for, since 1950. So for 50 years, there was a downward trend, and it was pretty orderly. It stayed within that channel, the decline of the share of income for labor. And yet from about 2006, 7, 8, there was, it's now broken the channel. It's broken that support line. It seems like where does it go?
Yeah, it totally broke support and it's in free fall. And let's ask ourselves, are there some kind of programs in place that will reverse this? No. And if anything, they're making the situation much worse. You know, to wit, the debate on the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling debate in America, whether they need to go from $14 trillion in debt to $16 trillion in debt. And they're having this debate about cutting spending. Simultaneously, while they're having that debate, they're paying for the ongoing workings of the government by taking money out of Social Security. The Social Security pie, they're just taking money out of this. They're just draining it anyway. You know, so the fascists are saying we have to get rid of the entitlements. And entitlements are the savings accounts that were built up by workers over since the FDR created the Social Security back in the 1930s. They've been accumulating savings in these accounts by having their money deducted from their paychecks every week or every 2 weeks. Now that money is being stolen from people in the government who are saying, well, we're going to have a debate about whether to raise the debt ceiling. But while we're having the debate to keep the lights on in America, we're just going to shrink Social Security, which is a huge savings account that's being destroyed by government. When they get finished destroying Social Security, they will then make all retirement accounts, including 401k, those will become taxable, and then they'll be confiscated. So just like, again, I point to that 12-part series on YouTube about the collapse of Argentina. All of the savings of the country were confiscated by the government to pay for the debts that were imposed upon them from Citibank. Which were then nationalized by the government of Argentina, who was working for Citibank. This is happening now again, but in countries all over the world, particularly in Greece. Greece is having their country's savings and assets stripped by these foreign banking interests that got the government to guarantee the foreign interest debts. We've seen it before. And not only that, but George Papandreou, the prime minister, it turns out that he is also, like Bono, walking away with a lot of money that he stole. You can go through that particular sequence of credit default swap, pilfery.
Well, yes, we've covered this on Kaiser Report, and this information comes from Dr. Tobras, who we've interviewed several times, and he's going to be in Hotspots Greece as well, and also from coveringdelta.wordpress.com. but there were charges by an MP named Kamenos in the Greek parliament charging George Papandreou with treason. And the charges, the allegations are that when Papandreou came into power on the slogan, how was he was running on something like, there, we are not broke, we have money. And so he came into power in December of 2009. At the time, the Greek Hellenic Bank, which is Postbank, which is the government finance arm, owned 1.3 billion euros worth of credit default swaps on Greek debt. So if Greece went bankrupt, these credit default swaps would have been insurance against that. So Papandreou came into power in December of 2009. Apparently, immediately, he went to the IMF within weeks of coming to power and told them, this is like not public at the time, he told them that they would need about 110 billion euro bailout. At the same time, he took those credit default swaps, which remember are basically insurance against Greek default, he took those and sold them to a group of Greek oligarch investors who were based out of, who kept their fund in Switzerland, i.e. so they paid no taxes. And he sold it to them for $40 million profit. So he sold it to, for $1.34 billion, okay? Now, Greece then went to the IMF, and it was public. Immediately, the credit default swaps soared, right? Skyrocketed. And now those credit default swaps are worth $27 billion. But he got rid of them. And instead, today, what, they took a $19 billion new credit line from the IMF and the EU? So this is a situation. So the treason is that he got rid of these credit default swaps knowing they were about to go bankrupt. And also even though he was publicly in the press saying naked short sellers are, this is illegal, this is against the law, we're being attacked. Remember, he was very vocal about, we're going to send the our intelligence services to find these people. Well, his government, his central bank, expanded the window in which one could short their debt. So it used to be 3 days, and now it was 10. And this sent the credit default swaps soaring even more by thousands of percent.
Right. So, a few points. One, treason.
Yeah.
All right. Is it treason? Yeah, it's treason. He stole, what does it work out to? $23 billion, basically. $20 billion?
$25 billion.
$25 billion he stole. He with his friends engaged in acts of
wealth redistribution.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was market manipulation and insider trading, the same kind of stuff you see on Wall Street with the subprime loan scandal, the bailout scandal, the Goldman Sachs scandals, the J.P. Morgan scandals. You know, Papandreou, the prime minister of Greece, somebody got to him. You know, we know that they had visits from John Paulson and other hedge fund managers, but he was totally turned around. This is a guy whose family has roots in Greece that go back generations, and yet somehow he was gotten to by Wall Street banks who turned him around, turned him into a guy who's, yeah.
Well, actually, my inside information from Greek people is that, one side of his family, his father may have been Greek, but his mother was American, and this is why a lot of Greeks don't really consider him Greek. They don't think he's very, he likes Greek people. So this could be, who are the American banks as well who profited from this, like Goldman Sachs?
Well, yes, of course. They make the huge fees. And is it treason? Yes, it's treason. Do the people therefore have a case for a regime change? Well, I mean, if you can't have a greater case for regime change than if your prime minister commits treason. Well, I mean, isn't that the very definition of the case study for regime change?
Also, odious debt, it then becomes, there are mass protests planned for tomorrow, again, in Smegma Square.
Smegma Square? What kind of square is that?
Smygna, Parliament Square.
All right. And there was this huge banner unfurled, I saw, five stories high, about the people protesting. So remember, it was just 2 or 3 months ago, people were saying, oh, the people in Greece are protesting, but they're not really serious about it. There's just a few kids. Well, it seems like it's getting serious.
Yeah, well, the posters were basically along the lines of thieves, bastards, gallows are coming. These were the latest protests in Parliament Square in Athens, where people were walking around holding, with like placards with nooses on the end.
Oh, yeah.
And it had signs saying, thieves, bastards, gallows are coming.
That sounds like a good song. Thieves, bastards, placards are coming. Thieves, bastards, placards are coming. Da-dun, 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 da-dun. Thieves, bastards, placards are coming. We need a good song.
We needed a little bit more punk rock than that.
Yeah, what it sounds like. What's that song?
Yeah,
we need.
It's like a Wizard of Oz song, man.
It is like Wizard of Oz, isn't it? The flying monkeys out of the butthole of the Wicked Witch of the was it East or West?
I think it was the East.
The West. Who was the friendly witch from the East? Wasn't it, or the West? It must have been the East. Anyway, we'll find out. We have to take more mushrooms to delve into the art.
I would think that the West would be the nice witch, because that's where all the gold and silver people were, and the East were the central banker type guys.
Well, I'll have to get some gummies. Hey, speaking of silver, you know, we're giving away a lot of silver these days on MaxKaiser.com and on PirateMyFilm.com. And on PirateMyFilm.com, I'm going to be giving away lots more silver to people who leave comments on various posts. And if you haven't gotten in on this one, you know, this is a good way to get cheap silver, because we're giving it away. We've given away so far in the last 3 days, 3 or 4 ounces, haven't we?
I think we've given away 3 ounces now in the last few days, including somebody from Greece, one named The Saint. Jishinger won a silver. He's also the guy who made those financial terrorist cards.
Mm-hmm.
And the previous winner was some guy in Canada, Joe Hunt.
Well, I just to give you a preview, I've got 100 ounces to give away over the next couple of weeks.
Wow, am I allowed to win?
Of course, yeah. You have to play by the rules, though. You have to leave, play by the rules. And I've got 100 ounces of silver to give away in the next couple of weeks, mostly on the PirateMyFilm.com site, as we are now scaling that up. The your film, Hotspots Greece, is getting some good action. You're trying to raise $1,600. To finish that project and then release it to the pirate networks, because it's called Pirate My Film, isn't it? So the idea is you just release the film into the pirate networks. It's 49% funded, so you've raised $695 of the $1,500 needed. And we've got people like Wolf Furl has made a commitment, the Telecrap Urinal. We've got Stefan 69. A Thornless Rose, Jojo, Chadwick, they've all reserved shares in the project, Hotspots Dublin. And it looks like this will probably hit the $1,500 needed threshold in the next week or so. I'm thinking things are starting to pick up here. So then that looks good.
Cool. And we're giving away an ounce of silver today on piratemyfilm.com.
Yeah, that's right. On a post that was made by one of the Pirate My Film members, Climate Babes, his post, which is on the front page, the comment number 300 gets a 1 ounce silver Kaiser. So this says only 8 comments so far, because we don't have the community just being built from scratch here.
Well, by the way, I want to inform people, it's the Wicked Witch of the East and the Wicked Witch of the West, and there's Glinda, the Good Witch of the... there's the Good Witch of the North, and Glinda is identified as the Good Witch of the South as well, so...
There's four witches. You can't, no matter where you go, you find some witch. That's been my experience.
That's really nice. Okay.
What?
That's not very nice at all. Yeah, so you could participate in Hotspots Greece. Everybody liked Hotspots Ireland. And Hotspots Greece is shaping up to be similarly good, a bit more of a different sort of energy. You know, there's a you can definitely compare the two. There's the different sort of participants, different sort of responses going on, because there's definitely a much more organized response in Greece, though it seems bizarre. I think a lot of people in Ireland could learn from what's happening in Greece, because there's certainly a very clear-cut case of fraud that happened in Ireland, and yet you don't seem to see any legal cases or anything happening there.
Right. As you've noticed, the people in Greece who are fighting the banksters are high level people with advanced degrees and lawyers and doctors, and they are really mobilizing at the very top of that society. In Ireland, no, nothing at the top is mobilizing, only at the bottom. And of course, you know, having just watched this history of Ireland, that plays into the history of Ireland. It's always had this status quo of the elites have always been running Ireland. And this is part of their history. But it's interesting when you go in, you make these films and you go into these places, you become, you know, there's a, you make the film, we make the film, we're about what we see there and we're trying to get some information. But being there, there's a feedback mechanism, isn't there? So the being in Ireland, talking to people about what's going on, that very concerned and shaping their lives, it can't help but inform how the film appears and sounds and looks and the music and everything. So there's a lot of feedback that goes on. So when we make our films, we don't go in there with a predetermined outcome. You know, we let the story tell itself.
Yeah, well, compared to our stuff we did for Al Jazeera, we would travel somewhere, and with Al Jazeera, we would script it, kind of. Like, we knew where it was going to go, what we were looking for. And with the Hotspots, the theory is that we're financial war reporters. So you just drop in behind the front lines and speak to the participants and find out from them why they're fighting and who they're fighting against.
Yeah, and it shapes the editing. It shapes the music selection. It shapes the performance. It shapes the voiceover. And it shapes the film. And it really comes out. So looking ahead, Stacey Herbert, after Hotspots Greece, the series is so freaking successful, and we're raising money for them on piratemyfilm.com. What town is next to get the Hotspots treatment, do you think? Any candidates?
Well, there's certainly Madrid. There's Reykjavik. I mean, they're kind of like, Reykjavik is a successful rebellion, but it's obviously still it's post-revolution. They threw out all the bankers. They did what everybody else should have done. Maybe the U.S. one day, perhaps, when there's a neo-Marxist revolution, we'll go see what's happening.
Yeah, that's right. And Madrid is a good candidate. Obviously, in Portugal and Lisbon, there seems to be some action going on.
Yeah. And by the way, I want to make a note that it's not just the content of like what the people say that determines the music. It's also, for example, when we filmed Hotspots Ireland and you come back and look at the footage, it's very gray there. It's very kind of sad. There's a kind of a sad quality to the air anyway. I think it's obviously natural because there's a lot of music from Ireland that's very sad. But Greece, is very hard to put music that is even a little bit somber over. It's so bright, it's so sunny, it's not like the colors are so rich, but they're very like bright and sunny, and it just is, that's why all their music is also very da 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 da, you know, it's very upbeat and fun.
Oh, speaking of music and Bono.
Yeah.
We haven't played this one in a while.
Uh-oh.
And This has really become the reality of Bono's existence. You know, Bono has become a fascist, basically, and merged with the banksters. Now, this came out in 2007, And it was at a Bank of America conference where, you know, the banksters got together for their semi-annual conference talking about trends and sales and things that they were doing. And here we hear from one of the banksters introducing one of their members who has rewritten a U2 song. One life or one high or one this.
Anyway, this is one bank.
Yeah, so here we go. Let's see what this sounds like. Oh, we gotta turn the volume up.
Turn the volume up.
Some guests who have been so impressed with your results to date.
Well, he's just talking to people.
He's talking. Ooh. He's talking.
Hit the mute button by accident.
Max always hits the mute button.
Unmute it.
You keep on hitting mute. It's mute now.
How do you unmute it?
Hit it.
Hit that?
Or go up to your audio thing. Yeah, there you go. You see, this this is old school radio.
Chandler, who is one of our Manhattan
this guy just bleats on and on like a freaking
what? He's goat. one of their Midtown managers.
Oh there my he god, is. They actually have a guitar.
Look at this audience, all the blue shirts, white shirts, Smurfs.
It is even better now that we're the same.
Right, this was the merger of Bank of America and somebody.
It wasn't Merrill, was it? Capital One, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Capital One, yeah.
Two great companies come together. Now, MBNA is B of A.
MBNA. MBNA.
Weren't they that big credit card company?
Yeah, Mortgage Bankers, something or other. So MBNA merged with Bank of America. And I think their credit card was called the Capital One card.
Okay.
And it's one bank, one card, one name that's known all over. World, one spirit, we get to share it, leading us all to higher standards.
Higher standards.
I think we, I think this is enough for us, but because Bank of America is also in the news yesterday. Abigail Field finds smoking gun on Bank of America securitization fraud. So this was just out yesterday, and it turns out that they bought Countrywide, right? Are Countrywide mortgage-backed securities really mortgage-backed? Do banks even have the legal right to foreclose on certain homes? Well, it turns out that they didn't actually, a top official at Bank of America said that she acknowledged on record in a deposition that Countrywide never conveyed the mortgages to the trusts and that Countrywide notes weren't endorsed except on a case-by-case basis, generally long after securitization ostensibly occurred. So this woman, Abigail Field, actually went to all these courts and to the public records and looked at all the public records to see how many of these were actually conveyed, how many of the mortgages were conveyed to the trust. It turns out like very small, like 1 or 2% ever were. So they don't actually own any of the mortgages that they sold in mortgage-backed securities, which is wide-scale fraud. So there's some sort of settlement being negotiated with the Department of Justice. Apparently these banks, including Bank of America, have offered, I think, $5
billion. Yeah.
And the Department of Justice wants more. Their initial offer was $25 or $30
billion. Mm-hmm.
But again, they're just going to pay a fine, which they'll take anyway by adding extra fees on your credit card,
yeah,
or cash transfers or currency exchange.
Yeah.
And then get away.
Yeah, that's right. So just to be clear here, what's going on here, the Bank of America loaned money to a homeowner in the form of a mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
That mortgage was immediately taken off their books by packaging it in what's called a securitized pool of mortgages and then resold. So what this is saying is that the pool of mortgages that was sold on did not contain any mortgages. It was just a vapor product. We've been talking about this on this show for years, is that the transactions on Wall Street, and when I say something like, and I've said this many times before, I say two bankers sit down at a bar and they both write $1 billion in lipstick on a cocktail napkin, and then they sell that $1 billion cocktail napkin to each other for a 2% fee. They both walk away with that 2% fee, and they walk away with each other's cocktail napkin with the smeared lipstick. Now, people say that can't possibly be true. But in the context of what you just said, the Bank of America took billions of dollars worth of mortgage pools that contained nothing. Now, how is that different than a cocktail napkin? It is the same thing. It's nothing. It's just a blank piece of paper that says nothing. They write a number on it, $25 billion or $50 billion. Then the bank that they're dealing with, the quote-unquote counterparty, whether it's Wells Fargo or Merrill Lynch or Goldman or J.P. Morgan, does the exact same thing, and they charge each other a fee, which they count as their earnings, which then makes the stock go up and the options go up, and then the executives cash in their options based on the higher stock price, pumped up by exchanging worthless pieces of nothing. And so now, we've been saying this for years. Now the regulators and the investigators are saying, wait a minute, this is all vaporware. This is all completely a pyramid scheme with no pyramid. It's just based on nothing.
Well, no, because remember, we're talking in the beginning about fascism and whether or not there's going to be an anti-fascist revolution. And one of the signs of fascism, remember, we gave retroactive immunity to all the telecoms companies.
Yeah.
Okay? Well, this is what Fire Dog Lake is pointing out. Somebody's actually gone out and looked at all these the public records and found that Countrywide and Bank of America do not own these mortgages. So they're saying this is a bombshell. If the regulators were in any way competent, DeMartini's testimony, she was the top official at Bank of America, would have stopped them cold. They would have engaged in the same analysis as Abigail Field and presented to B of A the stark truth that they have no ability to foreclose on Countrywide loans that were securitized. This means that homeowners have a legal case here, and as well as investors who were scammed when they purchased the securities. But none of this has been done. The Obama administration is not investigating in this, and they're not doing anything to stop it and or to address it. So I'm imagining they're just going to provide retroactive immunity. I know you've said this with a retroactive robo-signing thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be some sort of retroactive immunity from lawsuits on this.
Right. Again, there are millions of people who are being foreclosed upon based on mortgages that don't exist. And those people, of course, are ripe for the anti-fascist uprising. But why don't those mortgages exist? Why did those people take on those mortgages? Well, because the bank showed up on their doorstep and said, "Hi, Mr. Jones, you don't have a job, you don't have any income, but I'll lend you $500,000 to buy this shack at the end of this dead-end road. If you'd like to borrow $500,000 from me, you don't need an income or a job or any assets." Why would the bank do something as seemingly stupid as that? Because the second Mr. Jones signs his name to this fraudulently induced predatory loan, the bank flips it into a trust that they sell to another bank for a fee. So they are not taking any risk. When the trust blew up, as it did in 2008, and it continues to blow up, then they bankers send their representatives like Hank Paulson down to Congress, who say, "Give us $1 trillion or $5 trillion to make good on all the bad loans that we originated. Or, by the way, we're going to kill your economy and blow up the stock market." Everyone, you know, we saw this again last week, Stacey, the stock market dropped in a scary way. Why? Well, this debt ceiling debate again. The debt ceiling is at $14 trillion. They want to raise it to $16 trillion because they don't want to have to actually conform to any standard of accounting. They just want to keep creating more fiat debt out of nowhere. And when the Congress balked, they said, "Okay, we'll have it your way then. We're going to take the stock market down." They're threatening once again to destroy the market what I call financial terrorism. I don't see how you could call it anything else. And they hold, and we talked to Naomi Prince about this, this market making that Goldman Sachs says that they do is really also market destroying, where they can simply push the button for massive fake sell orders to hit the market in high frequency trading and blow the market to smithereens for political ends. That's not a market I can believe in. Are we out of time?
Yeah, we're running to the end of the show, but finish up with your thoughts there.
Well, so more of the same. Now, I've posted, in case you want to hear the rest of that Bono song, I posted it on to maxkaiser.com, the Bank One Bono song. It's quite something. You can check it out there.
Maybe somebody should remash it and just say, we don't own one mortgage.
Right.
Something of it. Because also, remember, Bank of America is foreclosing on these homes, but there's no chain of title. Nobody owns these mortgages, so they can't actually resell it. And this is a big problem going forward for the U.S. economy, which is so, you know, heavily invested in these mortgage-backed securities in the mortgage market. We could have these empty homes that nobody owns.
Right. And the answer is always the same. Print more debt-based money. And the answer from the rest of the world is now becoming all unified and the same as well. Okay, then we're going to buy more gold and silver.
That's a good place to end the show then. And remember, check out piratemyfilm.com because there's a Silver Kaiser on offer there.
That's right. We're giving away the first of 100 Silver Kaisers on piratemyfilm.com. And until next time, this is Max and Stacy saying bye, y'all.